Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 114. I'm comedian Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, the live circuit slash the Edinburgh Fringe. That sounded more aggressive than I was expecting. Joe Caulfield is a comedian, writer, and blogger who started her career out writing for Graham Norton while running her own open mic night between waitressing shifts. I got her on to talk about developing her relationship with her audience, what she likes and hates about TV panel shows, as well as her thoughts on the Edinburgh Festival and her relationship to it, as well as the social media persona that she cultivates between her and her audience all year round and how that helps her at the festival. This was an incredibly detailed and honest and brutal in places episode. I loved putting it together and hearing her thoughts, which were as fresh as they could ever be because we recorded it just after the Edinburgh Festival had finished in 2018. I think comedians at all levels will get something out of this. I also think fans of comedy will get a look behind the curtain in such an in-depth way of someone who has a really high profile but kind of is picking and choosing and navigating this industry in such a interesting and decisive and calculated way, and how she's able to continue to make choices to help her career progress but on her own terms. I really enjoyed this and I really loved hearing her. Before I hit play on the interview, I just want to say I've signed up for Edinburgh next year and I have no details to tell you other than that. I don't have the room. I know it'll be sweet venues. I don't have the time. I know it'll be sweet venues, and I know it'll be a full run. Does that help? I don't know. Oh, and I'll be taking Wednesdays off when I get rudely awoken by the dustman, as per usual. So that's all I've got to say about that. I'm about to start previewing in January, February time. I'm also going to be doing a tour afterwards. No dates have been confirmed yet for any of those things, so I'm sorry that that is the most vague plug. What I'm saying is check my website and check the show notes for links to my previews, as well as the Edinburgh Fringe run, as well as the tour, because that's the main thing I'm working on at the moment. That's the thing I should tell you about. This is bad because I've gone off script to give you some plugs and it's starting to sound completely DIY again. So I'm doing Sex, Drugs and Other Things I Never Do, the 2018 show from Edinburgh at the Bloomsbury Theatre on the 21st of March 2018. If you have a look in the show notes, you should be able to find the link. Please do come down to that if you can. If you want a discount code, if you came to like a preview or you came to see me at another time, please tweet me something that means I know that you listen to this. Tweet me my favorite macaroon flavor is strawberry, right? Tweet me that so I know you've listened to this and you came and saw me or something like that, and I will give you the discount code. I don't want to put it out in the world for everyone to see because I don't want anyone who isn't a lovely loyal listener to get that discount code. So if you can come to see that show or you can bring some friends or whatever, please do, as it might be getting recorded for a DVD release thing, because I'm trying to master all of the antiquated mediums possible. I did a book last year and I'm doing a DVD again next year. Be great. I might look into I might look into parchment paper next year. That'll be a fun thing to work on. Anyway, so that's about all I need to say, but please do come down and support. If you're new here, please do remember to hit the subscribe button. If you're old here, please do remember to give us an honest, ideally positive review in iTunes. And either way, please do remember to join the Facebook group. It's called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on Facebook, obviously. But for now, without any more delays, this is Joe Caulfield.
Yeah. I always start with jokes. Right, I need to have some good, strong jokes for next year. And then I'll put those into club sets. Because doing clubs and good clubs is where I go, well, that is, I know is a strong enough joke. Because these people have just come to see a bill of comedy. They're not interested in me remotely. So it's standing on its own as a joke. I'm also on with comics who are fighting fit at doing 20 minutes. So it has to be a good enough joke that they could do it as well. You know, that it's just of that sort of standard. So this year I had some jokes. I had an opening joke about Peaky Blinders, people wearing those Peaky Blinder hats and saying, well, it's really good because then... If I look, I've forgotten my joke already. That's how the festival is. So what was it? Oh yeah, so I'd see a lot of men wearing those Peaky Blinders hats, and that's quite useful because then I can tell from quite far away that they're a bit of a wanker. And it's a really just strong opening gag because it also it sets me up as like, and they're like, oh, that's what Joe does. Oh, she'll just, you know, slam things down and be rude, but it's fun, you know. And then start with a few jokes so I feel strong, and then put them in club sets. And the more involved stuff comes much later, where I thought, well, I do have a thing about, I find it interesting that men talk in a conversational way. They talk in facts. And my husband has mates where he goes, oh, we just talk about football all night. I go, what do you talk about? Football all night. Someone else, he has a mate, and they talk about music all night. That's what they do, all night. Occasionally, one of them will talk about something emotional, and my husband will be like, oh, it's a bit weird to start talking about his wife, you know. And so that, a whole thing I wanted to do about men and facts, that came doing actual preview shows where there's an audience of, and I've got good over the years of knowing who runs good previews. Because that's the hardest part, is finding a good preview, because there's absolutely no point. And I think I only had one that I thought, this isn't a preview. It was in some sort of center for people who weren't doing very well in life in Hartlepool. And I walked in and I went, oh, this is like a community center. This audience is just a completely disparate group. They won't understand what I'm doing. And not that I'm esoteric, but they're much more, I'm going to have to bring this to them and just do the jokiest bits out of it, because I don't want to do the bits that aren't like that, because they won't work and that'll put me off them. But finding good places where you go, no, if you can get, there was one I did in Ormskirk, he runs a really nice one, and he said it's only 40 people but it's packed in a small room, it sells out. They know what it's about. And that was one of the first ones I did. And that was great, because then it gave me lots of confidence to mess about and see where, right, this is a good area, that isn't a good area. And it changes a lot from the beginning of the preview, what I think the show is going to be, to what it ended up being in Edinburgh. And because I was rehearsing for the play, the last piece in my show this year, I do a piece about pornography and about threesomes, basically about finding some porn and going, oh, isn't it weird that it's threesomes, always two women and a man. And then I asked men, and there's fun in that because they always say another woman, would you have an extra man or an extra woman? They go, an extra woman. And then I go, do you know some men say, well, I wouldn't, I'm just happy with my wife, because some men do say that. But then of course they feel really caught out. But I did that, and then I write a porn film, but it's all very silly. It's from the point of view of course, I would go, oh, that's nice, someone to chat to. And I'd bond with the woman, and then I'd go, oh, I've had sex with my husband a lot. Let me, you know, tell me what you think of it. And that kind of developed by doing it. And then I wrote another porn film, which is all callbacks to things in the show, come into the porn, and that would be the end. And I only did that once before Edinburgh, because I didn't have time to get it together. And I did that, but again, it was a very good preview that Jason Cook runs in South Shields, Custom House there. It's a good audience for comedy, and that was the last thing I did. And I didn't know if the callbacks would work. You're doing it going, do they remember that I said that thing about Paul McCartney? Oh, they do. Oh, great. And so then knowing, all right, then I can put more. And then I put more callbacks in because I realized, of course, the audience are paying attention and you can just mount them up. So it's a long process, but start early. The earlier you start, more you can get on board. And then I can ditch some. And then sometimes I'll ditch some of the jokes because I don't need that. That's just a jokey joke. I can put it in a club set. But it's just in the way. It's not taking me anywhere in the Edinburgh show.
So your writing process for an Edinburgh show versus a club set sounds like disparate in that your club set kind of is just not off cuts of it, but like the kind of punchier off cuts of it.
Yeah, punchier. You just can't stay on the same subject for as long in a club set. You can, like I've got some stories that I do in stand-up show and I can do them at a club where they're really into me. Or it's more, there's a more concentrated atmosphere, like not like at the Comedy Store, because that's just too big in a way for this. But I have done these stories in clubs, but you have to kind of gauge it on the night and go, no, I think I could do it. And also my stories nearly always have a strong punchline because there's nothing worse, I think, than going that all that way and then going, oh, there's nothing at the end. Just you enjoying my company, that's not enough, I feel. So there has to have a strong punchline. But sometimes you're, yeah, so you do, and you can see the audience going, why is she still talking about that? It seems really weird. No, she must have been talking about it for 3 minutes. And they sort of start to panic because that's not how long you should talk about something. There's a certain amount of time and then you have to move on. Or you take that subject, but you go somewhere else with it. But there is a definite, you can feel it in them when they're going, oh no, this is wrong. What is she doing still talking about that? It's just weird. Because it's only 20 minutes, so you can't spend 8 minutes doing one thing. I might spend 8 minutes sort of talking about relationships, but there's loads of things in that bit. But I don't think of it as, I suppose I do. In sometimes I don't have a place for a joke in the Edinburgh show, but I always keep a joke and then go, right, well, I have that joke. And then I go, oh, that could go with that. That would be a nice run of jokes together. But they sort of always have to be, I don't do jokes, just unrelated jokes. Like I have a list of, oh, these are all about appearance to start a show, or these are all about going shopping, or these are all about TV. So if I get one, then I go, right, then I need to find some others that can put them in a little bundle together.
When you go on to a club set, do you have 20 minutes in mind, or do you just go, or even when you turn up to the room, do you sort of think, I know this club, I know this 20 minute works, or would you always go with, actually I've done that 20 minutes last time, they might all remember it kind of thing, I'll bring out some new bits and mix it up. What's your process for dealing with a club?
Funniest thing, this end of this, just before this festival, was I do always do a set list. I write out a set list. I've got a little notebook. Sometimes I'm writing the same thing over and over again, but just the process of doing it before a gig, I like to do some preparation. Because as soon as I think, oh, I didn't prepare, you go, well, that wasn't so good. Oh, because you didn't prepare. So I like the process of doing it. And also sometimes it reminds me and I'll go, oh, you've forgotten, because I'll do that as well. You've forgotten a part of that joke. You've been doing half the joke. So that process of going through it. But weirdly, this time I was thinking, oh, there's some stuff that I did in my Edinburgh show last year that has only just now got really tight and punchy for a club set where I can do it in a club set and it becomes a slightly different thing. And I was all excited about that and going, oh, now I've got to ditch all that. But I can bring it back and know it. Now I can bring some of it back. I can't remember which bits it was, but there was certainly a bit I went, oh, that's really, really working now. In a club. And I suppose it's because it takes you that long. Some things you know straight away, right, that's straight into a club set, that works. But other longer pieces you go, oh, I don't know if I can do that in a club, or I'll try it and I go, oh, it's not quite. And then you do it a bit more and then things get tighter and more clubby. So I will then now, because I've got stuff in this show Edinburgh, like the threesome thing, I think, oh, that can definitely work in a club, but it'll be different because it'll have to be shorter. But there's fun in asking people a question in the audience where you know what funny lines you can do about it. It's not just randomly asking them a question. Like last year, I had a thing about couples' names, that me and my husband, I don't like our names, I say. And we don't sound fun. Who's coming round? Joe and Stuart. Oh, they sound, what, those two old Scottish men, they don't sound fun. So I would ask couples their names and then invent a whole thing about their names. And it was just fun. And you could see people going, wanting to be asked, going, oh, I hope she does us. Mm. You know, and if they've got a good name, like an interesting name, you could see they would say, well, I'm Arabella. Mm. And then you can take the piss out of them for loving their own name so much. But also just being very rude and like, I mean, I had a Chantel and a Dean the other night. And they could have, I said, no, you're like a Laura and a Richard and you're from Surrey and you're lovely. But they had these terrible sort of Essex-y names. Mm. And it was just really funny to play with that. And you go, God, who knew there was so much in people's names? Mm. And then I would come back to me and my husband and how actually, if you don't like their name, you should change it. And I said, you've got to change it early. And I should have said to him, oh, instead of Stuart, I'm going to call you Julio. And then we'd be Joe and Julio. And then you sort of have a get out of it. So I thought the thing with the threesome, I thought, no, that's a good thing. And also the describing the threesome of going, oh, and we can chat and we can talk about it. Thought that will definitely work in a club. So I think I've got first gigs back are actually a weekend at the Comedy Store. So I'll do a mixture of stuff I know definitely works and then that I've done in clubs before. And then this stuff, new stuff to put in. And I'll be developing a new 20 then from that to go, well, I'm going to do that 20 for a while. But I always sort of mix in other things because it's just, then you go, oh God, there's so much. And go, oh, but I quite fancy doing that. So I could put that in. So I know some people just have a 20 and they go, that's my club set and I'm going to do that for 2 years or whatever. But I never do that, which makes it more work for yourself. But I feel it means that I'm always, I want to be excited about what I'm saying. And as soon as I go, yeah, that works, but I'm a little tired of it. Put it aside and you can have it again later. But put it away and then put something else in. So I'm sort of constantly kind of refreshing it. And then you'll go, oh, well, because I've put that bit in, then I lose that bit. So now I've got to add that, you know. So I will be, that'll be a thing to do, is to go, what is going to be your 20-minute set for this autumn? And it'll be a little bit of rearranging going on. But then that keeps it interesting as well.
And when you retire a sort of 20-minute set, like, have you got like sort of a, I'm bored of it, or I've done it on like, especially TV comics I've spoken to have gone, you pretty much have to burn it at that point. But then some people have gone, actually, they come to see it because they're kind of like, oh, I've seen it on TV. Oh, I know this, or I know this one, she's done this one, it's really good. Like, do you find that promoters, you know, if you send them like a clip of you doing like McIntyre's Roadshow, they go, come down, we want that. Or do you think they come down and they go, just do what you want?
I've never heard a promoter say anything like that. Ever.
Okay.
I suppose they know me anyway. So I've been on the circuit. So this, I suppose, is different if you're sending it to a promoter who doesn't know you. But I think increasingly TV is so disparate, you know, we're all in our niches. So it's not the thing. I think I did the first series of McIntyre and that did make a difference to my profile. Mm. Now I don't think Live at the Apollo makes much difference now. Because people, they're seeing so many comics, they're seeing so many, they don't remember. They remember if they really like somebody. And I think, like you, I think they, if you like a routine, you like a routine. Mm. So if you did the same thing on everything, you know, and I have seen them and go, God, is that the only piece they have? Because that's what I see them do everywhere. Then that's bad. But I think you can just rest things for a bit. You know, I did do a line and then I think, oh no, I can bring that back. I can rest things for 5 years or something. And then if I feel like, oh no, that would fit beautifully in there, because I feel it's my stuff, you know, it's like a musician. If you want to do it acoustic, it's your song, do whatever you like with it. If you want to rearrange it, you know, and re-record things. So I think of all my material as like mine to do with whatever I want. So you can bring things back and you can revamp things, or you can go, oh, I didn't know how to do that before, but now I know how to do it. Because you get better, or you change, or you have new skills. And you go, oh, I used to not be able to do that sort of thing. Oh, I think I could do it now. But I don't really worry about things that I've said on television. You worry immediately afterwards. After it's gone out, you worry for a sort of couple, you know, maybe 2 months that you think everyone is going, but we just saw that on television. But then you realize they don't, and they don't remember. Or like you say, they actually quite like seeing it because they enjoyed it.
Mm. And how do you, because obviously Twitter is a place where people can love and hate you very quickly when they've seen you on TV. How do you deal with like Twitter haters, and how much do you embrace sort of people that go, oh, I loved your, you know, do you let that big you up too much, or do you kind of just keep them as they're just all comments and I don't take any of them on board?
It's it It is a tricky balance, because I sort of feel you can't take either. So if everybody, it's not to dismiss their opinion, but if every, you know, if people are really enjoying the show and they're tweeting, "I really, really loved it," and that's it. I sometimes don't read them, like especially in Edinburgh, because I think, yeah, but you don't know what you're talking about. You've come and you've enjoyed it, but I've got to keep my eye on what I'm doing, and because I know my faults, and they'll go, "Oh, you'll get too comfortable and you'll be rambly." I have to make myself stick to the words and keep it tight. I'm always saying, "Well, keep it tight, keep it tight, keep it tight." I always say to myself, tight jokes, loose show. When you're doing the actual material, that's tight. When you're talking to people, that can go, but don't do that with the material. So I honestly try, it's weird because you're sort of trying to be engaging with people, but at the same time not to go, to let it affect you of going, "Oh, but they just love me. They really love me. So, oh, it doesn't matter." And then if people hate you, they don't bother me so much, the haters, because I know that not everybody can like you. So I don't really understand why people get so upset by it. And I've got in trouble with people, certain comics, who I think there's a sensibility around now that I don't have. And I thought I was being supportive. Somebody had put a thing saying that everybody hates them on social media, and somebody had said some really nasty things. And so I put a thing saying, "But you've got to realise it doesn't matter. This isn't about you. This is just a thing they want to do. This is someone who doesn't know you at all, and you don't know them. And they're saying something because that is what they have chosen, to say something mean to someone they don't know, and it's not based on anything." Then I got a massive reply from them, and I thought, "Oh, now you're doing it to me." Yeah. Of going, "Well, it's not like that. It's really hurtful, and you shouldn't let people get away with it." And I was like, "Oh, right, well, if you want to stew in it," I think some people like to stew in it. I do kind of think, so what? You know, and then people go, "But they said they wanted to rape me." I go, "Well, people have said they want to rape me." You know, they do say terrible things, but it's a hobby. That's what they do for a hobby. And no, they shouldn't be allowed to say things like that about women. And no, they wouldn't say it about men. But they say there are other things about men. They look for whatever is, you know, the thing that you're allowed to do for that person. And they know that they can say women, you know, oh, whether it's age or weight or unattractiveness, you know, whatever it is that they can attack women on, they will do it. And so I'm always surprised when they go, "Well, it's really misogynistic. They wouldn't say that to a man." I go, "No, but they'll attack them in a different way." Mm. They know conventionally that's a way you can attack women. So I think I just don't see why you let them get you. They're not people who know you.
It's controlling your reaction to the problem more than anything, I think. Because Everyone lets little things get... I mean, if I get a tweet from someone that went, "You were shit today," or something like that, of course it's going to hurt me in that 3 seconds once I've read it.
Yes.
But after that, I sort of go, "Well, we can talk this out if you want. You can tell me specifically why I was shit." Or I can just go with, "Well, you're never going to come..." And again, this is not me going back to the, "You'll never see them again." But the kind of... I'm not for everyone. And I don't want to be for everyone. Because if I was, I wouldn't be getting anywhere. So... You can take the time to do that if you want, or you could have taken the time to tell someone you like that you like them. And I just think if you're the type of person who would take the time to just say "you're shit," you're not the type of person I want to come back and see me, because you're only, you know, you're probably looking for negatives rather than enjoying yourself.
Yeah.
And I don't want people that don't want to enjoy themselves.
No, that is exactly what they're doing, because then, you know, when I sort of see what they do, and then I look on their timeline and I see, "Oh, you're doing this to loads of people." That's why I say it's their hobby. That's what they do.
One person, yeah.
There were certain things that happened, like with the Scottish referendum. I realised, no, I have to keep out of this living here, because... And I have loads of friends who are SNP, big SNP supporters. Most of the comics up here are. So they will disagree with me and say, "Oh, it wasn't just SNP. It wasn't just SNP." But to me, I thought, no, you've got some crazies. And they were very violent people in their language. And also, it's just relentless, like a whole horde of them. And then they'll poke each other and all come down on you. And I just thought, well, this isn't a fight I can win. Mm. It's not fun, because I'm trying to find the pros and cons here. But of course, you can't. Because I nearly did a tweet about Alex Salmon today and went, "Oh, don't, Joe, don't. Don't, because you'll just, you know, you've, and then you'll poke the stick into the nest and then they'll all come at you. And that's just not fun because there's too many of them as well. And I think, and there's no room for discussion either. Mm. So sometimes you have to go, well, I'm not going to get involved in that. Sometimes you get involved in something and you go, oh, I didn't realize that was a, you know, swarm of wasps that was going to come out. You think you've said something quite innocuous, but yeah. Then you go, oh, right. People are really upset about that. So, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. You can never quite tell what you've said until you've said it.
Yeah.
And then it's really hard because people, especially tone is lost written down a lot of time. So
yes.
People just take what they want. Like there were some people, so this year, for example, a lot of women got to the final of, I think it was either the newcomer or the best show in the comedy awards and stuff. And obviously there was loads of discussion about that, given what happened last year. And you know, I was a bit like, okay, well, have your say. You don't need to make it too gendery here because, you know...
What happened last year? I can't even remember.
Well, if we stick with this year, for now, I think it was last year there were more people at certain specific venues and it was more... Was it last year? It might have been last year or the year before. It was basically all men.
Right.
And there were no women into the final. And then this year, I think there was... I think it was about half or it's about three quarters to a quarter... That's... No... I can look it up actually. I'm looking like a tit now, but forgetting the numbers on it. But there was just a lot more women in the thing.
Yeah.
And obviously, there was a lot more talk of, you know, sort of balance and gender equality and all that sort of movement. But then there was also discussion of whether there's a quota or whether there's an agenda behind the award. And there's an agenda behind every award because there's a prize. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you have a prize, you have a criteria. Therefore, you have an agenda to who you want to win.
Mm.
So it's not a surprise to me that. There's an agenda behind every award.
Yeah.
But people act like there's some sort of Illuminati, you know, secret BBC hands moving things around.
Mm.
And it just seems really odd to me. I mean, you've won two awards that have labelled a woman in it. So, like, you won the Chortle Funniest Female Comedian Awards a little while ago and the Funniest Woman in the Laughter Awards. And I wondered what you thought about gendering in awards.
Well, I'm very over awards.
Okay.
So the fact that you're talking about that, I'm like, I don't, it proves it to me. I have no idea what happened last year. This year, I tried to keep out of it. I know Larry Dean was nominated or think he won, maybe. Mm. I don't know. And I was pleased because I think he's very good. I also think he's very sellable because sometimes they give it to someone and it makes me laugh because they go, you can't do anything with that person.
Mm.
Yeah, they did a great show, but they cannot be used anywhere. And then you find out, oh yeah, you see, Brendan Burns couldn't do anything with him, and that happens to a certain amount of people. It's and then at the same time, and I'm going to ask her. So a friend of mine was on the panel. She's a journalist, and I go, I am never seen because I go. Oh, this is when you talk about quotas. I go, okay, so everyone was going, oh no, this person is only going. So what about older people? The fact that I consistently come up with new shows and new ideas in those shows and new inventions in the shows, that counts for nothing. I'm just not on the list that you of shows that you go and see. So that to me means, well, there's so many comics that I go, so they're not remotely considered. None of these people, Andrew Maxwell, he's not considered. He's an amazing comic, I always learn something. He's always got a great opinion on whatever is going on. We're not in it, so... To me, it's not a whole comedy award, you know. And also, it does, it's sort of, I think it's just best to keep out of it because it's so odd and strange. And some people you go, not at all. Some people go, yeah, absolutely. Awards are useful for putting on. So anything I've got and go, I'll put it on. I got an award from Scots Gay Fringe this year, Scots Gay for Fringe Show. That's really lovely. So I can put that up. It's like your stars, put it up if it'll... sell tickets and things.
Totally.
Yeah.
I make this comment without any judgment or comment on anyone who actually got to the final of this year.
Yeah.
But what I found really interesting was all the comedians I particularly love and go and see and you know, sort of, or even want to see or whatever it is, tend to be someone who's been going about 20 plus years or 15 plus years. Mm. And most of the people that get to, obviously the newcomer will avoid that just because that's the new one. But for the best show, I'm always like, how come there's never anyone... Or it doesn't ever feel like there's anyone who's been going X amount of years. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that someone who's 22 and has been going, you know, like a year hasn't got an opinion or hasn't got a valid opinion. I'm just saying I think you're better the longer you've been going, usually. Like, obviously, there are some people who never improve or never, and I get that. But it just seems odd. And then you have things like the I think it's called the Silver Comedian of the Year, or like the old comedian, you know, they have like awards for
oh yes, it was called Silver something, wasn't it? And again, you go, well, I what is that about? I was just like, I don't want to be part of that.
Yeah.
And that's not me being ageist. Just go, why are you putting me in that? Why would you do that? It just, I don't know. It just seemed ludicrous, you know, to put everybody in little things like that of these. Are, oh, I don't. Oh, God, no. Yeah, so it's weird. It's just always, it comes down to the thing of just, but I suddenly thought, oh, no, I do have a point about that, about the age thing. And about, so, and I was thinking of it for things like, you know, if it was a Booker Prize or things like that, would you go, oh, Hilary Mantel, she's getting on a bit, let's not read any more of her books. I thought you wouldn't do it in something else. You would go, oh, no, we presume people are getting better. If you're artistic and you're working at something, there's a journey in your work. But no, it's like after, you know, maybe 10 years, they're absolutely not considered, at all.
Do you know which awards or which credits you put on your poster actually sell tickets? Do you ever like check with them and be like, did you come because of this? Did you come because you were flyed? What brings people in now for you?
What brings people in for me, I think, I know from talking to people afterwards, because I do a charity collection, so I always talk to people afterwards, which I think is nice as well anyway. And they say, see you next year, which is lovely. Mm-hmm. See you next year, Joe, like I'm their pal. We saw you last year, or we always come and see you, or our friends said to come and see you. So an awful lot of word of mouth and consistency, that you're on their list because they've seen your shows before and you haven't let them down. So that's why I think it's a thing of, you can't just do a show going, oh, I got away with that, because you don't know. They won't come and see you again because you think, oh, that was okay, it wasn't great, it was okay. Well, then why would they come and see you again if it was just okay? So it has to keep up a standard. Twitter definitely helps. And I sort of cultivate people, which sounds awful to say it like that all year, but I have a relationship with people. And you can learn things either side as well, which is what is lovely about Twitter. And then it also widens, you know, because I'm very into certain types of music. So then I get some old punks coming along, and that's really nice as well, next to my more kind of Radio 4 Surrey people that come. So it's quite a mixture of people. And the other thing, in actually Edinburgh, I think what really works is any kind of show, where those lunchtime shows where you do a bit of what you do, whether it's Mervyn Stutter or Joss Jones does her showcase show, and people decide to buy tickets from those. Or I know doing Michael Parkinson's little chat show, those kind of shows, people will fight to get a leaflet from you because they're actively looking for what can we buy tickets to. And then they will go and see you from those. I don't think late night shows, pointless. Just do it for the cash if you need the cash, but people don't buy from that. But the actual terms of all, you know, the big leaflets, poster thing, I like you had said earlier, I have some posters that are mostly in my venue. So I have no posters around town at all.
I think in your venue, I always put up posters because I think if they've seen something else, it's convenient, they're nearby. You know, you get lazy, or you think, well, you know what, we've got a 20, you know, an hour and a half till the next one, and we've got to walk that way, why don't we see one more here, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I know that about 10% of my audience were in the venue, which is quite a chunk of people that just were like, it's the right time and you're here, so why not? And if they're going to take a punt on you, you know, you want them to be slightly invested, obviously, but if you can make that happen and add a few more people into your room, I think it's worth doing. But I don't put posters up all over the place because
I think it becomes just white noise. I think it just, they don't know what's going on. It's an awful lot of money. I also don't pay for PR. I do it myself through Twitter and contact papers. You can really do all that yourself now. I don't know what people are paying for half the time. And then also, I'm lucky because I've been doing it a long time. I have contacts in terms of people who know I'm here, like Radio 5 got in touch with me, or they got in touch with the stand to say, oh, we'd like to have Joe on. So people, a lot of things that people are paying PR for are going, oh, well, they got in touch with me anyway. You know, I can do that anyway. Mm. So, and all those little things, you don't know if they work or not. Oh, but they did. That was it. And then I did the afternoon show on BBC Scotland, Grant Stocks. I do a radio show with him up here. And I had people come that night who said, oh, we saw, and then the next day, and they said, oh, we saw you, it was a live recording. That was the one I cancelled you for. It was the live recording, the BBC Tent. And people from seeing my chat with him, not from weirdly from listening on the radio, but again, from physically seeing you be funny in front of them, went and bought tickets. So all those things in Edinburgh, I think, do work. If they see a bit of you being funny live, they go, all right, let's... You know, even things like doing STV, I don't think that makes people buy tickets. But there's something about, oh, no, you've proved it in front of them. That's worth spending money on a ticket.
I went too far this year. I overfought posters and I got a box made, which just had a hole in it. And it just said, please do not look in this box. And it had my poster in it. So I was like wheeling it out places, hoping people would like look in it. Because, oh, it says don't look in it. It's the Edinburgh Fringe, why would you not? No one looked in it because everyone thought someone's going to jump out or something. And so I was like, I've spent all this time and effort doing it. But I thought it'd be fun to hide your poster and like make it a little challenge for people to find. Went the complete wrong way because it just wasted a lot of time and effort. But I think you can do that, though, when you overthink marketing. You just have to keep it really simple and go, right, did that work today? Let's try it again tomorrow. Let's see if it builds. And then every day you sort of think, okay, like you said, late night shows, I don't find people, but I find the earlier shows do. Like lunchtime shows.
Absolutely.
People come down immediately because they're like, oh, yeah, we haven't got a slot for that. And they're there then. Or, you know, oh, we haven't planned today. Oh, great. We saw they were really funny for 10 minutes at midday. If they can be funny at midday, what are they going to be at 9 p.m.? You know, they're going to be amazing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, this year, all I did in flyering, and that's why I got a ton of flyers left, is because of where the stand is and because there's nothing in St. Andrew's Square, so geographically the festival is moved away. So there's no passing trade there. It's pointless flyering around that area. So the Brexit play, I thought, that's 300 people in the Pleasance Courtyard. They will, and it was a good part for me, so I thought they will like me. I'll have my flyer out, and I said, just do the queue when they come out. That's all I want you to do. Because, you know, and then you're not allowed to flyer in the Pleasance if you're from somewhere else. So I said, you can flyer sort of as you leave, but you won't be allowed to flyer around the Pleasance after that. But I thought, well, that's a great target, because that's 300 people at once who've just seen me. And the flyer said, oh, yeah, they're taking them. You know, and that's the thing when people are going, oh, is it her? Yes, thank you, we'll have it. But and then that was all the flyering I did. I didn't do them anywhere else apart from when I went like to Mervyn Stutter or something and did that. Then you give your flyer to them and they do a very sensible thing of they give everyone a bundle. Right. They have a little paper bag and it's got everyone's flyer in. So they don't have a gamut of people to get through. They just take one of these bundles, which is a neat way of doing it. Yeah. But I think there's a lot of smoke and mirrors and nonsense talked about with the PR and the poster and the big campaign. I think a lot of it is it pacifies the ego of the comic. And I've done that myself one year going, oh, I need big posters up. And then they put up posters and went, well, did that make any difference, Joe? Well, I feel better because I see them, and then realize that got more secure maybe. And went, well, that's nonsense, you know, because it's not worth the money of it. I think it's just building up and that people know you're there and always trying to find other ways to do what we were saying, other ways to do 10 minutes somewhere where there's a lot of people and they can see what you do and then they'll buy a ticket.
You do a new show every year and obviously there's the word of mouth of people saying you're great. Do you find that creatively, well, specifically the second part of that, creatively constricting? Because if they're telling each other, oh, she's great, she does this, if you come along with a new show that's a bit experimental or a bit different or a bit, you know, it's got new ideas in that you've not covered before or something like that, do you ever find that they're coming for something different and a bit, not disappointed, but they're a bit like, oh, they said that she does a lot of stuff on X and she did a lot of stuff on Y and we were expecting... Do you find that ever or is that...
I think I'm quite honest in that... honest with myself and with the audience in that I wouldn't... give them something that was totally different to what I normally do without saying that.
Right.
Like, I think they come to my show, well, they know my personality. So I think they know, right, Joe's going, it's funny. It's funny. And I even say to them, like, and I do like about 5 jokes. And then I go, if you haven't seen me before and you're going, oh, what's the show about? What's the show? Is this it? Yes, this is it. This is what I do. And I say, if you're looking for something deeper, fuck off now. And then I suppose I just do what I do. So I know that it's always going to be of a certain tone. But there are within that a lot of what I try to do is the variety is in the different ways you can do comedy. Like I want there to be lots of jokes, but also routines. So then have more observational routines. Then have something that is interaction that I have worked out how I get out of it. So it's got an end to the interaction. Then something that's a story, two sort of short stories that had punchlines, and then something that's not me just talking, and that this year was reading the porn films that I'd written. So it's finding devices and finding what are all the many different ways that I can put, that I can do comedy in an hour, so that there's lots of variety and it's not just me talking. So I think about much more about that. They might go, oh, it's different this year. She did a little act out thing. But really, they're not. They're just going to think, oh, it's still Joe. Like, I thought, if I want to do something, because I've been writing a lot about grief, I thought, if I want to do something about that, I would do it the afternoon and I would be very clear, this is a different show. Because I think it's not that you're not allowed to express yourself artistically. You've got to tell them what you're selling. Mm. You know, if you go, oh, we always go to Joe because it's really nice. She does a lovely pie and you get chips. And I don't often need a starter. And then we went and it was just salad. She just gave us all salad. And there was no warning that it was going to be salad. And that's not what we were in the mood for. Mm. Then, you know, I don't think you have a right to say, well, I wanted to do something different. Well, tell them. Tell them it's going to be different. And maybe don't charge, you know, £15.
Yeah.
If you're doing something different. I did have a thing in this year. I think comics should be much more aware of what their shows cost.
Yes. I got very frustrated this year because there are a lot of comedians who were charging what I thought was a ridiculous... I mean, this is the problem. I don't know what their venue costs. I don't know what their split is. I don't know. And I also don't know what their extra costs are with, you know, like I said, PRs and managements and stuff. But there were some people I was like, let's say you saw famous comedian Y, who's been going 15 years, do a tenner, and then you saw new comedian Z doing one for 15. You're like, I'll come see you in London then when you do it for a fiver at the Bill Murray or, you know, whatever it is. You know, it just seemed really odd to try and... But again, the problem is I can't judge it too much because, again, if you don't know what it's costing them, then you don't know what that is. But I do know what you mean, as in, especially economically with Brexit and with people being a bit not tighter, but just aware of things that are going. I kept everything to a fiver. Every show I was doing, fiver, even preview fiver, every tour show except for two are a fiver. Because A, it means I don't have to think about it. If someone says how much the ticket, I just know and it's easier. But also, I know I'm not charging an excessive amount and it feels like a nice round number.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who picks it for you? I do. Okay.
Because my agent doesn't have anything to do with Edinburgh, except that she just comes and watches the show. Because I when I went to her, I had already had my arrangement with the Stand. So as she has nothing to do with it, she wouldn't take any money. So I do it all myself. And the Stand ask me how much you want your ticket to be, and most of the evening shows were 12. And I've had it at 10 for a while, and I just thought, I'd rather keep it at 10. It feels like a 10 is a nice round number, and also I think it's only an hour. On tour, I do 2:45 minutes. It's an evening with, isn't it? But this is just an hour. I think that's a fair price. And also the Stand, I know, is different because they give you a much better split. So I do very well, that's fine, and I think that's fair on the audience. And another thing that I don't like that the venues do, but I just think comics should know what their ticket price is. And I'm always surprised when they go, oh, I didn't know they did that. That venues putting up the tickets on Saturday nights, I think is wrong. Because I think Saturday night, that's when people, usually, traditionally, people with a lower income go out on Saturday night. That's their big night out. So it's so basic capitalism. More people want to go out on Saturday night, so we're going to hike the price up. I just feel as a comic, you should be, you know, especially everyone supposedly being all lefty, you go, well, that's just being greedy. Just don't be greedy and say, no, I won't have that. But I'm surprised how few get involved in the pricing. The other thing I thought this year, some free fringe shows to the point where I'm going, you're going to ruin this for yourselves. I thought, I can't see another show where I have to listen to that bucket speech, where people were saying, shows uptown, are 15 and 20 pounds. No, they're not. Mm. Some weekends are 18 pounds. Mm. I'm in a venue. I'm not charging 15 to 20 pounds. So they were telling people to charge, to put in 10 pounds in the bucket. Mm. People next to me had got out fivers and then went, oh, no. No, you have to, and they got out more money.
Yeah.
So I thought they'd been totally bullied into giving £10. That's not the point of the whole point of the Free Fringe was people going to be able to, were going to see more shows.
Yeah.
They were going, oh, it's great. And people would say, oh, it's great. We book in the tickets for the shows we want to see. And then we just take a punt on things. Mm. And we saw this person, it was great. And we told other people so. And then they're now they're getting an audience. Mm. But then as soon as you're saying, oh, and it was £10, well, now they can only see two shows instead of four shows. Mm. People are getting, and I thought you're going to spoil this for yourselves, and it's greedy and it's not fair, and you don't have the same costs that people in the Pleasance are having. That is, that's an expensive place to go because this deal I don't think is great. Mm. But you're not spending the money that they are. I just thought it was totally unfair, and I just thought it's short-sighted and greedy.
Mm. But bullying's a sorry, I'm interrupting. But bullying to me is a good way of putting that, because I felt when I went to Free Fringe shows, I felt less pressured because I know the system a lot better than I feel a general punter would. But every time I heard that speech, that frustrated me, and I tried my best when I was doing it to basically avoid that comparison, because I don't think they are comparable. Like, no. When you come to a Free Fringe show, you come in for kind of a little bit more rough around the edge, a little bit more fringe, if you like. Yeah. Like, literally, you're coming in for something that you know is a little bit more budget.
The performer is greeting you and putting on their own music.
Exactly. And, yeah. So for me to go, well, it's a tenner there, so it should be a tenner. You're like, well, no, like you've got a room in a pop-up venue in a, you know, sort of squat that usually isn't used for anything, whereas they've got a classroom in a uni that's getting a lot of funding as a result of this festival. I get it, because it helps get more money in the bucket, but then you're going, do you need the money, because everyone needs money, but, you know, do you need to make them feel that way? Why can't you let them make their own decision about what to do? And I don't know. Yeah, it did make me feel uncomfortable in a couple of shows where you're like, just be honest with me as an audience member. Say, you know what, it's cost money to put on the show. If you got a fiver would be great. If you're not, a couple of quid would be amazing. You know, and also if you don't enjoy it, I always put this in. And I say, if you don't enjoy it, just look me in the face, say thanks and leave. Like, I'd rather you didn't give any money. I know that sounds really arrogant and sort of like in a privileged position to say, well, I can turn down, but it's like, I've offered you this. I've offered you this for free, and as a part of the ethos of it, because I was with PBH as well. As part of the ethos of this, I've said it's free before you've come in.
Exactly.
So I'm asking you for an optional donation, and I know some people, you know, were sort of not. Again, this is bullying is probably too big a word, but they were saying, you know, don't steal comedy, give us a donation, you know, all this sort of stuff. And you're like, how can you start a relationship? If you're hoping they come back, like we were saying before, how can you start a relationship with an audience member by saying, don't steal my comedy? You let them in for free.
Yeah.
You know, it's like paper ticketing your show and then going, give me that tenner on the way out, because you clearly had a laugh.
Yeah, that's totally not what it is. It's not stealing your comedy. Like you say, it's called Free Fringe. The idea is we'll put out our show and then it's up to you. Mm. You know, be lovely if you think it's worth £10. Fantastic. But I bet you don't think that about every Free Fringe show.
No.
Some you're going, do you know what? It's £3.
Yeah.
You know, or it's £5. And that to me was the whole point of it and why it was so great. And also that it was like, hey, open anywhere, put on a show, but it's not the same expense. And I think it was helpful for some people to get to share the audience around more. People were able to go to see more shows, but they're not going to if they went, oh, we had to pay £10 for that one.
Mm. Also, it's a pay-to-play festival.
Mm.
So naturally with pay-to-play festivals, I think I don't write off the money, but I automatically assume that if I'm going to pay it, like I'm going to pay anything towards it, just assume that at some point you might get it back from like a tour thing, but it probably won't be direct from the festival. And I you know, obviously there's people that like yourself who can make it work as an economy. There are some people who, you know, have their agent and chuck them in a big room and then they hope the tour will pay it off like I used to do. But if you're paying to play, like with a pay to play gig, you know, like we have a lot of them in London, you kind of can't turn around afterwards and go, I did well, didn't I? Can I have, you know, you can say it'd be nice next time if I could have some money, but I feel like turning the table, like the bait and switch act of doing that to an audience member doesn't set that relationship off on the right
path. And I'm not against them, the comic making money, obviously. No, and I thought that was what was great. I thought, well, this works for everybody. The comic's making money. The punters are getting a good chance to see more shows and cheaper. But they're now the comics are tipping, some, not all of them, but some are tipping the balance too much in their favor because they've got greedy and gone, oh, this is a cash cow. And you go, well, you could run it dry then. You'd be careful.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's talk about TV. Yeah. Let's move on from Edinburgh and talk about panel shows specifically. Do you enjoy panel shows?
I enjoy them once they're done. And I think the last time I did Have I Got News For You, I did enjoy it because I had good stuff. Because, I mean, what they do is they basically go, these are the stories that are in the news that we'll be talking about. And it was Robert Mugabe had lost the election, and they were saying that his wife was wanting to take power. And I was like, oh, God, Robert Mugabe, oh, this is a tough one. Oh. But then I thought about it, and I had some good routines. So I really...
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Enjoyed it. And also, they give you plenty time on that show because there's not as many comics. You know, that's why, you know, people go on about Mock the Week. Well, it's so competitive because there's seven comedians. Mm. Have I Got News For You? There was just Paul and me. The host wasn't a comic and the other person was a presenter, although she was funny. So there's much more space for you to get in a joke. And also there's less likelihood that somebody else has already said it. Because that's the other thing that happens on Mock the Week. You know, you're automatically, a lot of you will think of the same joke if it's topical and go, oh, and then go, oh, God, they've said that one. And that was the only one I had on that subject. And also it's sort of quite short stuff. Whereas Have I Got News For You, I thought suited the kind of things I do more. So I enjoyed that. And I do a radio show here, which I love doing, BBC Scotland. Because I went, oh, this is such joy. Because they do it like it's a quiz. So, and the idea is that people are playing along at home. But you can just be funny as well. But not in a way where you have to write a load of jokes the night before. It's just, oh, do I have any thoughts about Led Zeppelin? Or how do I know so much about roads in England? Because I'm on the road. And you'll have a little story. And it was just much more anecdotal and like, conversational, but having a quiz as well. And then they have a quick fire round, which is just a great way for you to just think off the top of your head to just think of silly funny answers. And that's very enjoyable. And it's a fun team, so I do like that. But there's, you know, obviously there's pressure with anything that's high profile. You know, high pressure, high reward is the thing. So, you know, you expect them to be quite, that you're going to be a bit, oh, you know. And then some things you go, well, I don't think it's me. Like I did News Quiz and I thought, I don't think it's me. I just don't know why. I felt like, I suppose I don't do topical stuff. I don't do politics because I get too angry about politics. I mean, I genuinely am quite political. So I find I can't be funny. I just want to yell about all of them and I hate them all. So I find it when people are making sort of jokes in a kind of, in a way that flatters them, you know, oh, Jeremy Corbyn this. I just go, he's just a disaster. What, you know, I get so angry about it that, and then I was like, well, that's really not very funny. Mm-hmm. Or they'll be funny about an injustice. And I go, I can't be funny about stuff like that because it's an injustice and I'm already angry about it. So it's just, I thought, well, it's not for me, I think. But I like stuff where it's more about life, then that's more where my comedy is. Mm. So, but they, you know, they're very good for profile. That's the thing. And it's become much more of a model now of, it's like a big advert. The best thing you want is to do something like Live at the Apollo, anywhere where you can do stand up. It's like you're being paid to do an advert for what you do. I did the John Bishop show and it was a really and they paid well and it was a nice clip, and you go, that is, what more could you want? That's you doing what you do, and that people see you, and then they would like you and want to follow what work you do and buy tickets on tour or see you in Edinburgh and things, you know. And that's the way it's gone, you know. Now, like, now Sarah Millican doesn't want to do her own TV show. That's an incredible position to be in. She's going, no, I'll go on panel shows and I'll go on the one show and do what I do, but has chosen not to do television because she didn't really enjoy doing her own show. That's amazing. You know, that, I mean, I like that because that's the power in the comedian, the power of live, but it's also because she has an amazingly high profile. Mm. So you can do that. Whereas most of us are going, oh, I just need, you know, I need to get a couple of bits of telly and radio just to remind people who I am.
Yeah.
I just need that, you know. And luckily, they repeat things. So people think you're on TV more than you are. So that's good. People are still saying, oh, you're on Mock the Week when I haven't done it for years.
Yeah.
But it's just that, just to see your face, or if it's a talking head show, just to see your face. They go, oh, we saw you talking about disaster movies the other night. And you're like, oh, God, people do watch those things. And I think it's also that you've got to be, as long as you're yourself and you sell yourself, because sometimes you've got to be very careful. Well, not so much men, but women have to be very careful sitting in a makeup chair, because makeup people are bored. And usually they're doing a load of men. And they've got nothing to do. And then they get a woman and they go, oh, brilliant. Yeah. Do you want false eyelashes? Do you want this? Do you want that? Oh, I'll do your hair all up. And I go, no, because that doesn't look like me. Mm. And so a few times, and I've seen women, I go, oh, God, you've done them up. And somebody once said to me, I really like you on telly because you always look like yourself. And I went, oh, good. Because I've seen some people go, well, it's not really a good advert because that's not you. You don't normally look like that, which is confusing because people should know what you look like and just be able to go, oh yeah, that's that person. So I think always try to be the you are on stage when you're on television, you know, which I think was why when I went on the one show, I thought, oh, I was the acerbic Joe Caulfield, not on the one show, because I've realized, oh, I'm a little harsh for there, because they like everything. That's the thing in light entertainment. And I realize, oh, if you go on those shows, you've got to do it the way they are, but somehow be yourself, because they love everything. Everyone who comes on is amazing and they love everything and they love everyone. And you see that, like, this weird, like, scariness in their eyes. It's like a, oh, what's that? A sort of bullying joy that you must like everything. And I'm not like that at all. And I think I made a remark about something. It was music. Oh, they had a stupid thing about what women, music women like and music men like. And the women's, I was like, well, why have the men got all the good tunes on this list, you know? And they were like, oh, but don't you like ABBA? And I went, yeah, but I don't just like ABBA. And I think, oh, when they said, oh, something really catchy, I said, oh, by catchy, do you mean shit? And then they were like, oh, and their horrified little joyous eyes went, oh, she said something she didn't like, you know. So I went, oh, right. So I think you have to make a decision. Like, you can't go on those shows and be moody and like, well, I'm not here for this kind of show. Well, don't do it. Or I have to go on there and go, right, how do I make it? And how do I do that show but still be myself? And don't look in their eyes, because they've got that sort of madness of enthusiasm for everything, no matter what it is. Yeah.
Because you're going to be edited in a way that you can't control. You know, most comedians who go on those shows don't have the power to say, I want to see editorial control, or I want to know what's going into it.
Yeah, no, you don't at all. No.
So no matter how much you try and play yourself, at some point they might edit you to look slightly different to what you are, or like edit a joke or put it in a different order to make it look slightly different, like you're more combative than you were. Have you ever felt like edited in a way that has made it look different than when it was at the time?
I don't think so, actually. I know some people have been on things and gone, oh, the way they edited it, I was hardly on at all. But I think I know that, especially with panel shows, I know you've got to be funny in every subject. Mm. There's no point going, oh, well, I was really funny about the Robert Mugabe thing, and then I didn't do anything on the next one, and then I did a tiny thing on that. But they'll put in all the Robert, because they go, well, do you know what, dropping Robert Mugabe completely. Mm. So I know that you have to be funny in everything. So some people sometimes feel they were unfairly edited, go, oh, it looks like I hardly said anything, but I did. And you go, well, they chose to make that subject the big subject. I know you only did one joke on that subject, so you have to kind of prepare in that way for everything. But I don't think I've been unfairly edited. No, I wouldn't say that at all. I think there's more, you know, I'd go, oh, that was my mistake, that I didn't realize what kind of show it was. And also, you have to change your mindset sometimes. Like, it was funny enough, it was the one show again, it was Paul Merton, and they did a whole thing about his name, Paul Merton, and who he might be related to, and it was their, you know, terrible sort of comedy piece, badly researched, and I was sitting there going, well, that's not his name. His real name's Martin. He's not called Paul Merton. I thought, doesn't everybody know that? How do you not know that? And I thought, oh, what's he going to do? And Paul Merton, quite nicely, but just straight away went, oh, that's really good. What a shame I'm not called Paul Merton. And just like awkward. The whole thing collapsed, yeah. You know. But I thought I would have gone, oh, how I really hate those kind of contrived bits of badly produced comedy. Mm. But he just deflated it, but in the nicest possible way.
Yeah.
You know? So he was true to himself. He didn't go along with it and go, or he didn't apologize, because it was their stupidity.
Yeah.
Whereas I think I might have got very annoyed. I have to control my being annoyed sometimes, yeah.
When you go on these, is it a case of you're looking at it, like you said, it's a paid advert, or is it a case of a stepping stone to being more famous, or is it, what's your discussion with, is it your management, I assume, who helps you get these, or do you get them on your own?
Yeah, I suppose they would get it, or sometimes things come directly, yeah. But I suppose it depends. Like I would never do that. I don't pay for PR. So if I was doing a tour, I suppose what happens with most people is, if they're doing a tour, they've got a PR, and the PR has said, you're going on this show. So you've paid somebody to get you on it. So that's a different thing. Whereas I would go, right, I do need people to see me. I mean, I never think of it in terms of, you know, fame is such a horrible word to use, but I don't think of it. I think of it as more, well, I need more people to know me and like what I do. That's the thing. I need to be on there, but I also need to be myself and hope that they like that and then want to come and see me. You know, it's a necessary thing for people to want to see you, for people to need to know what I look like, and to go, oh, that's Jo Caulfield. She does comedy. You know, that's my livelihood. So, but you know, that way madness lies, if you're going, well, I'm doing this show and then I'm going to be huge. Because also, be careful what you wish for, because, you know, having friends that are very famous, it's not easy. It's not an easy life, I think, sometimes. And I don't know how much of that I would want. I think everybody, most people I talk to would like to be their level and a tiny bit more. But even people who are really famous, they want more. And you go, oh, when does it stop? That is kind of crazy. But I know, you know, I need more profile to have a better tour. And that would be nice, because then I can do what I do. But at the same time, I stopped touring because I missed clubs. I love doing comedy clubs, and I love doing a bit hanging around with comics in a comedy room, you know. And I feel sorry for very famous comics who go, oh, you don't get to do that. I mean, again, Sarah's done a very clever thing of, she's recreated that in her little warm-up tours, and she does new materials, and she's on there with other comics, and it's a fun night. And I think, well, that's a really good way to do it, because otherwise you miss, you know, it's a fun thing.
Yeah, totally. And you've written for other comics before, and I wondered whether you'd ever ask someone to write for you, like if they'd given you a subject, or you needed someone to banter off of or to bounce ideas with.
When you had a radio show, yeah, you definitely need writers. And sometimes it's people to bounce ideas off with. But a guy, and he's not a comedian, he sells antique fabric. But he's very into comedy. But I will, if I'm doing a panel show or something, I will banter with him or go, what are your thoughts on this? And he'll just tell me thoughts. And it's just good because it starts me thinking. I need somewhere to start from, because a blank page is a terrible thing.
Yeah.
Of going, oh, right, so he thought this about whatever the subject might be, Brexit or something. So, oh, that could make me think of that. And it just helps me start. And I may not use anything, but it's helped me start. And I think it's worth it. I'll pay him just to get my brain moving. Because just staring at stuff going, well, I don't know where to start. And then go, oh, that was interesting. He had a thought about that. Oh, I could. Oh, from that thought, I've now got another thought. Yeah. Mm. So, yeah, you need to have people start you off on stuff like that. But things like, you know, the festival and thing, that, no. Then I don't have writers for that. Mm. Or generally just for stand-up, no.
Mm. I find when I change medium, so like if I'm writing something down for Twitter or I'm putting it on Facebook or I'm performing it live or I'm putting it in a podcast, whatever it is, I try and think about how they're going to consume it before I put it out.
Yeah.
So like with Twitter, I try, even though we got a bit more leeway, I try and make it as punchy as possible.
Yeah.
Whereas on Facebook, I might make it a bit more flowery, or like I have a bit of a build to it or something like that. How does your writing process change when the medium changes? And also, how does your performance style change, if at all?
Yeah, I like Twitter. And Twitter, I find I can be, well, Facebook is soft. And I don't really use that for work, I don't think. I put stuff out, but it's sort of, a large, you know, sort of family and friends, although as my friend pointed out, but you don't have 3,000 friends, Joe. They're not your friends. And I go, no, they are my friends. But I don't think of that particularly as a work thing. But Twitter, because it's much more punchy, isn't it? And the nature of Twitter, I think, especially people follow me, they know it's a joke. They know it's a joke, and they know it's going to be maybe quite harsh.
Yeah.
And they go, oh, you know, I mean, and it's weird, the people who retweet, like Alistair Stewart, the guy who reads the news, he retweets me all the time, because he'd come when I was supporting Rory Bremner. He came to one of those shows and we had a bit of a laugh. And then next thing I know, and then so I say to him, but I put everybody involved. I'm asking him, right, get Annie Nightingale. Not any, Mary Nightingale, to say this when she's reading the news and a little, and what do you have suggestions? Games. People love a game, and I like the game, and you'll say what suggestions, or I'm always asking people, you know, music suggestions to walk on, and people, and they get to make a joke at my expense as well. You know, they'll something, you know, be something like, you know, old dogs or something. I don't know. But, you know, they'll come up with things that are quite rude to me, and that's quite nice that they can be rude to me back. So, yeah, I think about it. And I think interaction is very good. People like to do interaction. And it's just a really very enjoyable because it's a free thing, and it's a back and forth. And I've found out about things through Twitter that I wouldn't have known about without Twitter. But I think the tone to me is much clearer on Twitter, that I can be harsher, more acerbic. They know it's a joke. You know, very occasionally people are like, well, that's a bit mean, but I'm like, but I am mean, you know, so don't follow me if you think it's too mean. So I think that's easy. And I mean, stand up, I wish, it's so elusive. I wish there was a way, but there isn't. But then again, if there was a way, it wouldn't be the sort of glorious, mystical thing that it is, you know, it's that thing of, I know that by sitting and trying to write, it makes my brain work. And I may not come up with anything, but I'm a great believer in the subconscious doing stuff while you're doing other things. And I do think writers need, and you need to have empty space time as well, where you do get in a zone. I find this more for writing pieces. If I'm writing a piece, I really do sort of sit and look, make cups of tea, walk around, go for a run. I used to listen to podcasts, and now I found, no, I'll go through the piece I'm trying to write. And I did that yesterday. And weirdly, I went, oh God, I've run 10K. I never run 10K. But it was because I was really, really thinking. But that's a different process to the stand. And I can, and that I sort of know how to do that kind of writing. But stand up, you go, oh God, how am I going to come up with a joke? Pressure, under pressure, always. I've got to be on a panel show. I will think of things. People are staring at me. I don't have a punchline. Your brain edits the punchline perfectly. That's why I'll often record when I'm doing new, because I'll write it on stage a million times better than I could write it.
Mm.
And then sometimes, have you heard that where something comes out just fully formed?
Mm.
You go, couldn't tell you where that came from.
No.
Absolutely wasn't even thinking something I was thinking about. But just then, came out.
But then when that happens to me, I always worry, have I heard it somewhere else? Have I read it somewhere else? Have I done the... You know what I mean? Because sometimes if it feels so perfect, you're like, oh shit, I've got to Google it. I've got to look it up and stuff. And you don't know. Sometimes when you're like, oh crap, but when it's yours, it feels the best thing in the world.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah. And I tend to know if I've heard something because I remember people's routines quite well. If there's something I really like, so I don't tend to worry about that. And occasionally, some people will have something similar, and I'll always say, I've got a thing similar, so you know, mine does this. I'll say it immediately if I see someone who's got something similar to me, because the last thing you want is somebody saying to them, oh, Joe Corfer's got a thing that's like yours, so say it when you see it. And then sometimes it is, and then you've got a bit of a routine, especially if it's observational, to go, oh right, people really hate that as well. It's just a small observation about people not getting ready in the security queue at airports, and then that developed into a routine of me saying that if my husband were a terrorist, I would know, and I do a bit routine. And what I like about it is I get to say things like, with him saying, but I wanted to set up an Islamic caliphate. Well, you can set up an Islamic caliphate when you put up those Billy bookcases. It's just lovely, like really common words with that. And that came out of that routine. And you're going, I don't know how that started. But it started from thinking, how do the wives not know? And then doing, what would be a husband-wife conversation, then you can add more to it. And then the whole routine that I had for the last couple of years that sadly has had to retire was the whole customer service with people asking how you are. And that became a huge thing. And because people were in the audience going, yes, because they were really angry about it and going, yeah, I'm fed up with people saying what you're up to today. It's none of their bloody business. No. And weirdly, some of the shops have stopped doing it. Someone in Marks and Spencer's, they said, we've been told to not to do it now because we've annoyed British people. We're not like that, you know. We'll have a chat, a genuine chat, if we want to chat. But yeah. So it's so elusive stand-up, you know. And there are people, I mean, when I've written for other people, I've written with people like Graham Norton. He still has Rob Colley writes his jokes. And Rob is one of those people who's like a machine. But I'm like, I can give the ingredients and I will go, right, this is what Graham will think about this person. And we would sort of hammer things out. But he could sit on his own and then come out 2 hours later with a page of jokes. And I couldn't do that. Because I just couldn't. So I don't write in that way. I might have three. And then I would have to go on stage and work out other things.
Yeah. When you start writing for someone new, like as in you're doing their jokes, how do you gain their trust? Is it a case of you've just been friends for a while? Or at this point, I'm assuming it's because they know you.
Yeah, they know me.
But when I first started doing
Graham's warm-up, and they had trouble finding writers that had the right sensibility. It was all male writers, and they were writing very old school gay man jokes, sort of John Inman-y. And he was like, no, I am actually a gay man and I fuck people.
Yeah.
So can we have things that are where I'm not pretending that I'm not gay and things? And Rob was already on board, and then they just gave me a trial, you know, and we worked really well together. And sometimes, you know, he would go, right, the joke will be, these are the ingredients, and I could come up with a punchline for him, or I could, you know, give opinion, you know, it just worked. We worked very well. I mean, we worked together for like 7 years doing that and doing celebrity joke. And because it was topical, I never felt like I was giving anything away because I thought, well, these aren't lasting anyway, you know, and it was really good learning curve as well. And then I wrote, but in a, this is a completely different way of writing, because it's not really writing, for Ruby Wax. She had a game show and she needed chat. So it was an earpiece thing. I would say what she should say to people through the earpiece.
Like real time?
Yeah, real time, which was a really odd job. And I was amazed how much she would trust that she would just say what was said into her ear.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of trust in that.
Yeah. But that was, you know, because I've got a comparing. If you've got comparing skills, you can host a game show. Because that's what it is.
Yeah. No, I always find it interesting how, I mean, predominantly I'm a writer, and I find it, when I say predominantly, I just have more of that work coming in at the moment, so yeah. I just sort of go that way. But I find it really interesting how people A, find that work, and B, continue to trust, like get trust from people, because ultimately, you know, there's a lot of if you're not going out and saying it, you know, it's all well and good in a little room where you've all had like a meeting for an hour about a joke, and in the room you get the context of it and you get the idea of it because you've all been there the whole time while the process has been building. Yeah. But one person has to go out there and say it.
Yeah, I think the way we used to do it on the day of Graham was that the researchers would have all the news stories printed out for us, and Graham, me, Rob, and the producer would read through. Graham would read through the news stories, and then he would say, and Graham would do it in like a riffing way. And so if he said something funny, right, we write that down. Mm-hmm. We also know which stories he's more interested in as well. So some of it he's writing himself. But also he would be like, oh, God, I'm not interested in that. Oh, we're boring. And that, so then we go, right, we know the subjects. And then lunchtime, we'll have a draft. And then what would happen then, which was weird, was the producer would read them in Graham's voice. And Graham would listen to them. And it was funny. He didn't want to say them until he was saying them in the run-through. And then Graham would go, oh, that's funny. Oh, that's funny. That's laughing. And then the producer would sometimes go of a joke that goes, I'm not hearing laughter.
Yeah.
And that was a really good thing for me. And I think about that a lot in certain things. You go, is that funny enough to make that punch in your stomach where you laugh out loud? And you go, it's not. And I'm not always right, but it's quite a thing to develop in yourself to go, am I hearing laughter? No, that's amusing. It's not laugh out loud funny. That could be funny to write in a piece, but that's not funny enough. And then it would whittle down or go, right, add more to this. And then Graham would do, first time he'd do the jokes, would be the camera run through. And he liked it. If the cameramen and sound men were laughing, he would get confident and go, no, I think these are funny, or that one. Occasionally he'd go, I'm not feeling that one, but I'll give it a go for you. Mm. And then, because he know we're standing at the side of the stage, so if it doesn't work, we have to then go, oh, really sorry, Graham, because that didn't work, but you did it for us. But that didn't often happen, but then, you know, they could edit things. But there was one that we thought was hilarious, and because me and Rob were laughing so much at it, Graham said, oh, I'll do it. They clearly think it's hilarious. Got nothing. Absolutely nothing, which then made us laugh even more. It's like, wow. But it's a funny thing to develop that sense of when things are funny, and when, because sometimes you just don't know. Sometimes I don't know until I'm saying it out loud on stage whether it's funny.
It's like I often see comedians go on stage and go, well, that worked on Twitter, and you're like, yeah, but it works written down. It doesn't mean it's working.
Oh, completely different.
Yeah.
Oh, completely different. I mean, it was very...
It's different mediums.
Yeah, I think there's hardly anything that I would put on Twitter that I could that would say out loud.
Mm.
You know, and the only way I thought I could use it was one year I thought, well, why don't I read my tweets? And then I went, why don't you write some jokes that you can say out loud?
That they can't just read before they get to the show.
Yeah.
That they're probably searching for when they're seeing what you're about.
So it's a different thing, isn't it? Yeah. Mm.
I think the only exception to that is one-liner comedians. I have a few friends who are one-liner comedians, and obviously they're going to test them out on there sometimes, and they'll sometimes work in both. But often I'm like, yeah, okay, you can kind of read your Twitter feed if you can remember it all.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, occasionally I've had something on Twitter that I've gone, oh, that is a good joke I could just do. But usually, no, they're for there.
How do you... Or have you ever had imposter syndrome where you've got like a new, you've been offered a TV role, or you've been offered a thing on a panel show, and you've ever felt a bit like, oh, like even in the early stage where you've gone, oh, I'm definitely ready for that. Or, you know, when you get there, have you ever felt, oh, God, I'm the new one here. They all know I'm not ready for this. Or have you ever felt like that?
Yeah, I think you do feel like that. I think everybody feels like that, feels like, oh, this is quite daunting. Because it's not, you know, the thing about panel shows is you often don't get a chance to learn how to be good at them. You know, like you're doing stand-up comedy all the time, and then the thing is they go, well, appear on this and don't do what you normally do. And you're like, oh, great, so this is my big chance, but I don't get to do what I normally do? Okay, this sounds really a good idea. So there's lots of things to learn of what kind of material to have, or how prepared to be, how much are you going to look at that piece of paper, or are you going to, you know, now I go, try to have the things in your head, try to be in the moment. And then the hardest thing of all, try to be relaxed. And now I've learnt that sometimes you're just not going to be relaxed. Mm. And the best thing, of course, is that, and you can't fake that confidence. You just can't. And now I know there's some things I do and I go, oh, I was totally myself. I was totally at home and I was fully firing in all cylinders. And then other ones I'll go, right, you're probably not going to be firing all cylinders. You're going to find, you know, that I always think of it as like go up into cupboards in my brain and then go, oh God, there's nothing there. Or the door's just locked. I couldn't get in. You know, whereas when you're totally in the great state, you can get into everything and you just think of things off, so you don't even know where it's coming from. It's coming straight out of your mouth. It's great. And that's where you want to be. And the more you do it, the closer you can get to that. But I would still say at certain times I'm going on something and going, I think some of the doors are going to be shut when I try to go to them. And but it's doing it more that you get more relaxed and at peace with being able to use all the facilities you have in your head. But sometimes you go, oh, they weren't. And that's nerves and a fear and a wariness that can happen on sort of TV things sometimes. But I think every time I always say yes to things because I think every time you get better, you know, or it's all practice, you know, like I do, or I'll do a live chat show or a thing because it's all practice on how do you do these things, you know, because most of the time you're doing stand up, not doing these other weird things. That is how apparently you make your name.
I think that's really odd. Is like when people say, like afterwards, normally if someone says, oh, you're so brave or something like that, I think it's because they're watching you do, you know, a thing to 500 people. They don't see that you've done, you know, 2,000 gigs to 50 people and you've built up your skills and you've got better. Like they see the end result and get really worried about it. And I think that's easy to do because they don't have the perspective on it. But it's hard to sit them down and go, let me walk you through all the gigs I've done to get to a thing where I feel like I'm not just winging this, or I'm not, you know, taking up your time, or you're waiting for the better act, or whatever it would be.
Yes, yeah. And it's also knowing, I think it's also knowing your persona and who you are that you can to take to the other places. It's a hard thing. It's like if I was doing a corporate, I'm still me. I'm still Joe the comic. I will still be acerbic. I will still, you know, be rude to people. And make fun of them, and I think it's taking yourself in whatever medium, and it's still being your comedy self is what you learn to do because you've done it for so long on stage that you know where that person is.
Definitely. And I read a thing. This might not be true, so I read it online, so you never know. But I heard that you were working as a waitress. And you were saving up to sort of start your own comedy club. And then you met your now husband, and you decided to give it 2 years. And if you couldn't make it, you would just stop.
You see, that sounds very...
film like, plot line.
Well, or that, I mean, that I had any idea what making it meant.
Yeah.
I didn't. And also that makes me sound like I was very businesslike and had a plan. I was, but in a really weird way. I was businesslike and a fuck up at the same time because I'd left school at 17, come to London, was in a band, had shitty jobs everywhere and had no plan, life plan at all. Was just going, oh, as long as I can earn enough money to pay some rent. And then I worked in a shop and I worked in a bars and then I was a rockabilly and then I sold 50s clothing. And I liked working for myself and had a market stall and things. And I sort of enjoyed, I always kind of wanted to work for myself. I always liked that. And even when I was waitressing, I felt I was working for myself because I got my own tips, you know, and you could do more shifts or less shifts or things. And then I'd gone to drama school for a year because I was thinking, oh, everybody seemed to be, I realized the people I was hanging out with were a bit younger than me and they suddenly started going to college and things. And I was like, oh, fuck, I should have a plan. So I was like 28 or something, went to drama school for a year. And one of the exercises was stand-up comedy. And I really thought about it. Now, at the same time, I remember seeing a TV show. And this is how the thing, I have a memory for routines. And it was Jasper Carrot, and he'd gone to America, and he'd filmed in, pretty sure it was Catch a Rising Star or The Improv in New York. And it was one of those brick walls, we'd never seen that before here, stand-ups. And I just thought it was the most amazing thing. Jerry Seinfeld was on there. This is how long ago it was, in that he had a routine about women using heated curlers. I think, weirdly, they do. I've bought my niece some for Christmas. They do. But it was the old-fashioned ones. I remember my mum having like Carmen rollers and how you could put baked potatoes on them. And, yeah. And women, when they put their perfume on, he's going, why do they have these spots? Behind the ear, that's a spot. Behind the knee. Behind, you know. And I remember that going, oh, I really like him. And then Ellen DeGeneres was on there, and I thought she was amazing. And Paula Poundstone, she did a routine, because I really like, because I was waitressing. And she did a routine about working in the International House of Pancakes. And she said, and then she said a throwaway line of living my dream. And I thought, God, people still say that. And then she went, and if people were mean to me, I would touch their eggs. And I was like, oh, that is so good. Mm. And again, it was that thing of, these are just people talking. Mm. I haven't seen this before. This is amazing. I had a love for it, but I didn't know it was a thing that people did. And one of the students went and did a open spot at the Comedy Store, and that's where I went down to see them do that. Jack D was on, Mark Lamar was comparing, Sean Mio was on, and Mike Haley was on, who did impressions. And I was blown away by it. The guy doing the open spot had died of death. But I was like, but how did you get it? And he went, well, you phone up and you ask. Really? Like, you don't pay, you don't have to go to college. This seemed to me like, because I was also, that's what I thought, how do people get proper jobs? I have no idea. I have no skills. I've hardly any education. How do they do it? And this was like, oh, you just, and then I went to the Comedy Cafe and I won the competition the first night, because a lot of people do, because you're like full of it. You don't even know what you should be afraid of. Then that's when I was like, because I had an amp and a microphone and stuff from being the band and things, and going, all right, if I run my own night, then I can compare it. And I think 2 years seemed at that time maybe an inordinate amount of time. So the idea that I would stick at anything, because I didn't stick at anything, would be main. So I think it was more that I was going, well, 2 years, I mean, that's really a long time. So I'll give it 2 years. And then I'll have to chalk that up to yet another fad that I've gone through, like the drumming and like the singing and like the selling the clothes. And, you know, this is just another thing that Jo did, and then she did something else. But I thought it was the thing for me.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you, okay, so from when you started that idea to when the 2 years were up, what did you think making it was when you first started? And what did you think it was by the end? And how'd you achieve that? Because you've carried on, so I assume you had, but.
Yeah. Not being able to do any waitressing shifts.
Right.
Like when they said, oh, can you do this night or this night? I went, oh, I can't really. Because I've got gigs. I can't do any weekend nights. So I go, well, you can't be a waitress.
Yeah.
And I was traveling away. They said, can you do Sunday lunch? No, because I'll be driving back from Chester. Oh, well, you can't be a waitress. So to go, oh, and I'm now making a living. And I think, and then I started doing some warm-ups. Thanks to Laura Shaven. She got asked to do warm-ups. They wanted a woman. And she said, I can't do it, but I think Joe Caulfield would be good at it. And I did that. And that was Graham Norton's producer, Graham Stewart. Mm. So then he got me to do Graham, because Graham went, I don't want a man. I don't want like an old bloke going on. Mm. That was a very mainstream warm-ups then. Mm. Well, nobody, our sort of comics didn't do them. And then he said, well, there's a woman, Jo Caulfield. And he went, oh, I know Jo. Yeah. So she could do it. So I think it was doing Graham and then writing and then going, well, I suppose that took a while. But I think it was buying a car. And going, oh, I've paid for this car through jokes.
Mm.
And I state that to myself every single time. I look at it and go, right, this house, jokes. Everything's bought by jokes. And that's fantastic. And just writing more jokes. And going, that's all you have to do. Like, you can get sidetracked. Like, I was sidetracked by people in television going, oh, write a sitcom. Here's 2 years of your life down the shithole. And then going, oh, and I took my eye off stand-up. And then I really concentrated, and I just concentrated on being good at stand-up. And I don't think it was my idea. I think I heard Bill Burr talking about that. If you get a disappointment because, and it's people in television saying they can do things, and then you go, oh, they can't, and they've wasted my time. And he went, I just concentrated on what I do, and that's what I did. And I concentrated also on fun things. Then of going, oh, I'm going to do a fun evening. Oh, Radio 4 have commissioned it, have they? Oh, that wasn't the idea. It was the idea was to do a thing for fun and to explore it. And things have come out of if you're just concentrating on more material. I need more material, do things for fun, try things out, see where this is going, then opportunity comes.
Mm. Do you think you could do the same thing now if you started today?
That's very hard to say, isn't it?
Mm.
Very hard to say. One, they'd go, oh, she's quite old to be starting. I'd have to go into that silver competition, wouldn't I, to make a name for myself. I was lucky I started, you know, I started late then. I was late to start, you know. I was already 30, so, you know, that was late. But I didn't think it was late. I think it meant that I, in weird ways, I think I've had, not life experience, but I thought I've done a lot of shitty jobs. My friends are very varied from different parts of my life. I think it gives you a good overview. And I'm also very, I find sometimes comics go, you're not aware that these people in the audience, they've paid money, they've worked, you owe them something. I'm not of the thought that they should necessarily be honoured to be in my presence, and if they don't like it, it's their fault. You know, I do believe I have, as long as I feel I'm still being myself, then they have a right to expect a funny show.
Mm.
Yeah.
These are the last quick fire questions.
Yeah.
I think I know the answer to this one based on what you've just said, but I'm going to ask it anyway, and we can, you know. A lot of comedians call themselves comedians because that's the way they like to be labelled, but obviously their financial earnings show them as doing something else. Would you say that you are a comedian regardless of if you earn more money from like TV work or from writing work? How would you like to be labelled if someone said you could only have one?
Comedian, because I would qualify by saying that everything I do is comedy. And if I were, even writing is comedy, TV is comedy. So it's a comedian, and a comedian will have different genres. But I'm a comic or a comedian, yeah.
Okay. What's the biggest mistake you've ever made, and how did you overcome it?
Mistake. There are things that have happened that I thought, oh, I should have followed that up. Or that was bad advice. Like an agent gave me very bad advice, whereby I didn't take up an offer from a TV producer who wanted to do a pilot of my own show. And I thought, oh my, and she told me to turn it down. And then after that, I was going, my God, that was such terrible advice. It was a conflict of interest with production companies. And I thought, then I realized, oh God, she was totally wrong. There wasn't a conflict of interest. And then I thought, do you know what? I wouldn't have been ready. Mm. I wouldn't have been ready to do it. I think I was a slow learner. I think it took me a long time to find myself. And that's all part of the things. So biggest mistake. I probably will think of one, but I am a bit like, well, who's to know what was a mistake or what was actually, well, you wouldn't have done that well anyway, or, but that led to this, so that ended up being a good thing. Yeah, or I'm quite controlling about my career. So when you've had an agent that would maybe want to take you on, you go, oh, but they're a very controlling agent, and I don't like that. I like that my agent basically leaves me to run my own career, because I go, I don't like being told what to do. I think that's why I'm a comedian. So in that way, I go, yeah, because I do things in my own way, and I like that. So I'm sure I should say there's a huge mistake, but I can't think of one. Or I'm very clever at making myself think it's not a mistake.
Who do you think is the most underrated person in the industry?
Well, that's very hard, because I don't want to say a comedian, because then that means that I'm saying that they're not successful, and they might go, but I am successful. Or it might mean that I'm saying that I'm forgetting to say somebody else.
Yeah, I'm not sure if, I mean, I don't mean underrated as in they're not successful. I just mean people who you think maybe haven't been given just haven't got the level of notoriety, whether it be within their little group or within a certain subset of people who go to comedy. It doesn't mean that they're not famous. It just means that you feel they're sometimes overlooked.
I think, and funny, because I thought, oh, I always go and see a show, Gavin Webster, I think does suffer from being a Geordie, because I think he does clever shows. He does a show in Edinburgh. He doesn't do what he does in clubs. He has a thought, and he goes, right, I'm going to pursue that thought. And I think there's very funny things in it, and there's also some clever ideas. And it is that thing, you go, if you were Oxbridge, I think a whole load of people would be flocking about and saying how clever and interesting you are, but they're not, because you're an ex-engineer from Newcastle.
Okay. What do you think is the biggest problem in the comedy industry, and how would you go about solving it?
Well, I feel I don't have any problems. I think people just have to concentrate on the work, do the work, write the jokes, tour about. If you do the work, and then some people, I think they think they're doing the work, and you go, no, what you're doing is, when you come to Edinburgh, hanging around in the loft bar, you're thinking that somebody's going to give you a career if you meet them. If you do the work and are a good comic, things happen. I think Patti Smith, this is a quote from Patti Smith, and she said it. She said, don't think about making money. Think about creating good work and working with good people and making a good name, and then your name will become currency. And I think that's very, very true.
I would normally end by asking what's the best bit of advice you have been given, but I know you have an advice blog. So I've changed it for you, because I don't want you to go, yes, you could just read my blog.
Yeah,
why have you not
read my blog? Yeah.
What was the hardest lesson you've ever had to learn as a comedian?
I think I've learned a lesson, sort of, you learn it over and over again, and it gets less. I don't think there's one hardest lesson. I think not working hard enough, so you're not prepared for something, thinking, oh, I'll get away with it, and then going, you didn't. Taking an opportunity, say TV or radio, and then thinking, I don't know if it's right for me. Be brave enough sometimes to say, that's not right for you. And that's a hard lesson to learn, to be able to go, no, that's actually not for me. And then I haven't had it for a long time, but even live work, sometimes you can go, oh, I didn't really feel it. And then you go, oh, because you didn't connect. You know, it'll be a really basic lesson of stand-up that you went, oh, you just went out and you started and they didn't know this about you, or they didn't know that, or you didn't. And you go, oh, God. And sometimes you go, Christ, you have to learn this. Sometimes you have to learn this thing all over again. I mean, as I say now, I think that's less and less, because I think I've learned it so many times that I do prepare and I do connect, and I do, you know, because I go, you can't be doing stand-up this long and come off stage and go, oh, why didn't that work? Oh, because of, you know, something really obvious. Yeah. But I think for years, you learn that lesson over and over again. You learn how to do stand-up over and over again. Mm. And you'll go, there's always a reason why a gig didn't go well. Very occasionally, it's because it's a room full of people drunk and on coke who are really loud, and your microphone didn't work and it's unplayable. But very few places are actually unplayable. No.
No, I agree with that. Well, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
That was Jo. Hearing her take on writing for other people, as well as how she has had to change her voice to fit with Graham Norton's, as well as what she loves and hates about panel shows, and just every part of this was a joy to put together and edit down, and I felt like it was just packed with so much information, not unlike her blog. She has an advice blog, which is always the bare bones of what you really need to know if you want to become a performer, or I think the blog is called something like Things I've Learned as a Comedian. I can't remember. I read it on an intermittent basis, so I should know that, but I just can't remember what she actually calls it. If you Google Jo Caulfield blog, you should be able to find it. All of her advice about Edinburgh Fringe was like holding gold in this episode. I really felt so privileged to hear her thoughts on it and her opinions on how it was working, and I really hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you'd like to thank her or myself, our Twitter handles are in the show notes. Please do take a minute and thank the guests, because it really means the world to them and to me, and it shows them that there is a listenership that is listening to this and enjoying it. And so if I ask them for an introduction to someone else, they are more willing to do that, because they're like, hey, I knew that there were people listening and it was really lovely and I had a great experience and all that sort of stuff. So you're helping the show out by doing that. If you enjoyed this episode, why not give the episode with Beck Hill a listen? She talks about her relationship with her audience and the Edinburgh Fringe, as well as moving to the UK from Australia. Or the episode with Phil Jupitus, who talks about his hindsight views on being one of the team captains on Nevermind the Buzzcocks, as well as why he does the free and paid Fringe at the Edinburgh Festival. Both episodes I am I'm ridiculously happy with, and I think that they are definitely worth checking out if you haven't already. Really quickly before you go, I'm doing Edinburgh next year. Just a heads up on that. I don't know the time. I don't know the venue. I know it is Sweet Venues in the Grass Market because that's as far as I've got. I know it'll be a full run and I'll be taking Wednesdays off as per usual. Otherwise, I don't have any other details for you, but I just want to flag that I will be at the Edinburgh Festival 2019, short of like a big illness or the festival shutting down for a year or something like that. I'll definitely be there. Also, I'll be doing previews from January through to July, and I'll also be doing a tour afterwards, which I'm working with someone on at the moment, but I don't have any other information. I just want you to be aware that I'm working on stuff. Like, that is the information I'm trying to give you. So, yeah, please do come down and support. Also, if you'd like to come and see me do my 2018 show, which was called Sex, Drugs and Other Things I Never Do, I'm doing it at the Bloomsbury Theatre in London on the 21st of March 2019. I am plugging that one specifically because I might be getting it recorded for a DVD release. I say DVD release, it'll be on YouTube and you'll be able to buy a copy at my gigs on a pen drive or whatever. So, if you want to come down and you want to support me, that'd be the best way of doing it. I think the code I made for this was, if you tweet me or message me somehow, my favourite macaroon flavour is strawberry, then I will send you privately the discount link for the tickets for avid listeners of the podcast / fans of mine who have come to see shows in the past. So if you want to come and see the show for cheap, then let me know that you have listened to this and I'll definitely get you that code. I just don't want to put it out publicly because I don't want every old Tom, Dick and Harry having access to that. So, yeah, that's pretty much all I've got to say about that. The Ask the Industry podcast is a Fruit That Got in Gravity's Way production for the internet. All elements were created by me, comedian Simon Kane. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for subscribing. And thank you very much for rating and donating if you do. Or coming down and seeing me at a preview / the Bloomsbury / Edinburgh / tour. However you want to support me, please do that. I'll see you all in about 14 days' time. Bye.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.